Tucker and State on 90.5 WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. The United States is the premier nuclear power in the world, but the geopolitical landscape has radically transformed since the height of the Cold War. Meanwhile, our stockpile of ballistic missiles, nuclear submarines, and large bombers is aging and in need of expensive upgrades and replacements. So, as America moves forward in the 21st century, what kind of nuclear arsenal makes sense? Here to help us answer that is Steve Pfeiffer. Steve is the former ambassador to Ukraine and director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. Welcome, Ambassador Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Before we get into the details, can you give us a sense of the scale we're talking about here? I'm sure the exact number is a guarded secret, but about how many nuclear warheads does the U.S. maintain?
Well, actually, it's not a secret. In 2010, the United States released a number and said that as of September 2009, the total American stockpile was 5,113 weapons.
Okay.
Which is a huge decrease from the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, there were 25 or 30,000 weapons. But you still have to ask the question, does that number make sense 20 years after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union?
What about the dollar cost of maintaining that arsenal?
The dollar cost in terms of maintaining them on a day-to-day status is estimated at, say, $30 to $40 billion a year. So it's a part of the defense budget.
Wow.
But where the costs get really big is if you look, say, 5 or 7 years down the road, where the Navy's going to have to start building a new ballistic missile submarine to replace the Ohio-class submarines, which have to be retired in about 15 years. And then you're talking about an estimate of $6 to $7 billion per boat, not counting the missiles or the torpedoes.
So upgrades are hugely expensive.
Well, or replacements. I mean, a submarine can basically operate for about 35 years, but then it just gets to the point where you've got to retire it. So you have to build a new submarine.
Okay.
And they're trying to find a way to cut that cost, but shipbuilding prices usually go up.
Are we still producing more nuclear weapons, or has production of new nuclear weapons stopped?
Well, when you talk about the nuclear weapons per se, actually, we don't produce new nuclear weapons now. What the policy is, we extend the life of existing weapons. So they'll do what's called a life extension program, where they'll take an existing weapon and they'll go and replace those parts that have basically reached their shelf life, but basically keep the same weapon intact. And one of the things that we've learned in the last 10 years is that nuclear weapons in the American stockpile actually have a much longer longevity than had been anticipated, say, 25 years ago.
Okay. But again, we're getting back to the number. We're talking a little north of 5,000.
Come down to maybe in the last 4 or 5 years, the guess is it's probably come down to more like around 4,600, 4,700.
Okay. Okay.
So it's moving down.
The other key player here is Russia. It's Russia and the United States. Even after a new START treaty is implemented, Russia will still have at least 2,000 nuclear weapons, from what I'm told, and plus an untold number of non-strategic weapons, likely numbering in the thousands as well. What is Russia's place in this discussion?
Yeah, the guess is that Russia has about 5,000 to 1,000 total nuclear weapons, so roughly the same as the United States. And this is one of the issues about the new START treaty, which President Obama and then President Medvedev signed in 2010, is that treaty, which is a good step, it limits each side to about 1,550 deployed strategic warheads, but it only covers those strategic warheads that are deployed. It doesn't address reserve weapons or tactical weapons. So it covers only about 30% of the U.S. arsenal, and maybe it's time for the United States and Russia to begin talking about limits on all of their weapons.
And I misspoke a minute ago. I guess the new START treaty has been implemented already. Okay. All right. The United States decided to restructure its European missile defense approach. How does this alter the situation involving Russia?
Well, it remains to be seen, but for the last couple of years, Russians have been not enthusiastic about reductions going beyond those that they've already agreed to in the new START treaty, which is now being implemented. I think the Obama administration would like to reduce further. One of the reasons the Russians have said they did not want to reduce is because of concern about the American missile defense plans for Europe. And phase four, the last phase, which is the one of most concern to Russia, was canceled. So hopefully that removes an obstacle that then might allow a resolution of differences on missile defense, which then could remove an obstacle to further negotiations. Now, the initial word out of Moscow is not encouraging, But the Russians often react very slowly to the ideas. As one of my colleagues once said, the Russians say no, no, no until they say yes. So hopefully we haven't heard the final word.
How have our allies in Eastern Europe responded to what we've just announced, or what you just referred to?
I think the first three phases were primarily aimed at defending Europe. So in phase two, there would be a missile interceptors in Romania. In phase three, there'd be interceptors in Poland. Now, those will go ahead, and those interceptors will have the ability to protect Europe. Phase four was going to be, though, a much more capable interceptor that could intercept intercontinental ballistic missiles coming from Iran to the United States. So, and basically, I think what the Defense Department has concluded, there's probably a more efficient way to defend against the United, to protect the United States. So this plan doesn't affect the ability of missile interceptors to defend Europe. What we've done is we've canceled phase four as we looked for a more efficient way to defend the United States.
But does the cancellation of phase four, does that amount to some kind of olive branch to the Russians or anyone else?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk to people in the government, they say the cancellation was driven by technical questions about phase four and budget questions. They say Russia was not a consideration. But it has to have occurred to somebody in the government on the U.S. side that if we cancel this, which the Russians have been complaining about for 3 years, that has to have some kind of a positive impact on Moscow.
You referred to Iran just a second ago. We've got to talk about Iran. We've got to talk about North Korea.
Sure.
What about the threats that they pose, and how does that figure into this?
Yeah. Well, a part of the decision would be to deploy additional interceptors in Alaska, which will give the United States some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, one of the things the Defense Department said they're going to do is they're going to test and prove the technology before they actually deploy new interceptors, which is a good step. Because I think some of the interceptors that were deployed in Alaska were actually put into the field before they'd been fully tested. So there's some questions, how capable are these things? But that gives us some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, remember, North Korea, they've had one successful satellite launch. They're still probably a number of years from having a missile that could reliably reach the United States. And I think Iran is further behind. So the missile defense conversation in the United States has been...
Is further behind?
Yeah. It'll take Iran longer to get a missile that could reach the United States than it will take North Korea. So.
Okay. But that's geography, right?
It's geography, right? Yeah. Iran now can fly missiles maybe to 2,000 kilometers, but they need to get 5,000 miles to get to the United States. And that's just a longer way down the road. And the debate about missile defense, or what the U.S. government is trying to do, is basically stay ahead of that, is have missile defenses deployed before North Korea and Iran would get missiles that could reach the United States. And so far, I think that's a race that the U.S. probably can do fairly well in, if they get the missile defenses to work.
If reducing the overall nuclear threat is priority number one, if we assume that that is the goal, what needs to happen here in the short-term future?
Well, I think the biggest thing that the United States could do is working with Russia is to reduce our stockpiles. Because while the United States and Russia each have about 5,000 nuclear weapons, the nearest third power is France with only 300. And it's very hard, I think, for the United States and Russia to go to third countries and say, don't build up. Or go to a country like Iran and say, don't acquire nuclear weapons when we have such a large inventory ourselves. Now, if we are reducing our arsenals, I think that probably is not going to affect directly a change of mind in North Korea or Iran. But what it does do is it gives us greater credibility with other countries to apply pressure on North Korea and Iran. So I don't think it's a coincidence that in the last 3 years, when we've had the New START treaty, the United States has had more success in persuading other countries to crank up economic and financial sanctions on Iran.
What's the acceptable level? I mean, you threw out this 4,600-4,700 number most recently here. What number makes most sense in your view?
Well, I think the next step in a U.S.-Russian negotiation only would be to try to get all nuclear weapons and try to come down to about 2,000, maybe total weapons. I think it would be hard to get the Russians to go much below that without bringing in third countries, which I would say for the next step, because once you bring in third countries, your negotiation becomes much more complex.
Okay.
Ultimately, I'm a member of Global Zero. I think if we could reach a world where we could be confident that there were no nuclear weapons, which would require huge verification measures beyond what we have now, an enforcement mechanism, I think from an American perspective, that world has some attraction. We have friendly neighbors in Canada and New Mexico, the protection afforded by the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans, and very powerful conventional forces. So, and that would avoid the risks that I think are growing of use of nuclear weapons as more countries acquire them. But that's a long way down the road, and a lot has to happen to get there.
Steve Pfeiffer is former ambassador to Ukraine and the director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. It's been very special to have you in the studio here today. Thanks for joining us to discuss nuclear weapons in the 21st century.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Scott Westerman is a longtime telecommunications executive, entrepreneur, and broadcaster. He's currently MSU Associate Vice President for Alumni Relations and Executive Director of the MSU Alumni Association. Scott's also a contributor to Current State. Here's conversation recorded earlier this year with Scott and MSU women's basketball head coach Susie Merchant.
The name Susie Merchant is probably as familiar as a family member. She's in her sixth season as head coach of the women's basketball team here at Michigan State, balancing the pressures of a Big Ten program with the adventures surrounding parenting of two boys. Welcome to the program, Susie.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my wife, Colleen, wanted me to ask you, what's the breakfast fare at your household?
It's called a little Cliff Bar, a Z Bar. So tell her that there's not a lot of breakfast happening. And usually a stop at Quality Dairy for my caffeine and maybe a donut for the boys.
She wants me to send you her oatmeal bake recipe.
Yeah.
Coaching Division I basketball is a pressure cooker. How do you keep pace and maintain some semblance of a life outside of the game?
It's hard. I mean, I think that's the one thing I will tell you that has been a challenge for me, especially early when I first got here. I mean, I had been a Division I head coach and actually a head coach since I've been 25, so I understood that. But this level is just a different kind of feel. It's a bigger stage, obviously, a national stage, but the recruiting, the outside demands of the job, I mean, that was a little bit more than I understood coming into the position. And I had just given birth to my first child when I got the job here. So I remember one day after about 7-8 months on the job, and so we're about halfway through our season, I would go in Ty's room when he was only about 6 months old, and I'd, you know, cradle him, and I would feel guilty. You know, I'd feel guilty as a mom because I wasn't there all the time for him. And then when I was at work, I felt guilty. And then when I was at home, I felt guilty about, you know, maybe not making more recruiting calls or watching more film. And so I had one of those aha moments, as they say, where you just say enough's enough, and I just have to change what I'm doing and not beat myself up so much, and really just try to compartmentalize both situations. And, you know, when I'm a mom, I'm going to be a mom, put that phone down, focus on my boys. And when I have to be a coach, I'll be a coach. And if there's a time where I can merge them both, so be it. But in the meantime, I think the best thing I can do is just be 100% in the moment.
That's a common challenge, I think, for more and more working moms in Michigan now, isn't it?
It is. And there's not many women in my profession that have a family. And if they do, a lot of times their husbands don't work. And my husband has his own career. He has his own company. So he's a busy guy. So we really rely on a village of people from, you know, my folks early on lived here with us and helped us to now we have a great babysitter / nanny, a Michigan State graduate student. So, you know, all in the family, we're all Spartans.
Everyone asks you about the basketball season. I want to talk about the stories that don't make the front page in the State Journal. Madison Williams, highly touted recruit, high expectations, and a series of injuries that would make a lesser athlete give it up. She hasn't missed a game this season.
Yeah, Madison Williams, boy, your heart just on one level breaks for her. On the other side, just fills up with a lot of inspiration and joy. You know, she is a tremendous human being, Scott. Above all, she's got high character, a very strong in her faith person, too. So I think she relies a lot on some of the adversity she's had. She just sort of, you know, prays about it and gives it up and, you know, believes that there's a higher calling and another purpose for maybe why this has happened to her. But she's an inspiring person. And one of my favorite stories about her is after she's blown her ACL, her knee, basically three times. And as you mentioned, she's a 6'7", McDonald's All-American, could dunk. I mean, is a game-changing program changer in our game. You know, after this third one, after she got over the shock and the disappointment, she came in my office a couple of days later and she said, you know, Coach, every year that we do the Hall of Fame and they hand out the varsity jackets, you know, at Wharton Center there, she said, I never want you to give me one. I'm going to earn one. I'm going to get on that court. I'm going to play. I'm going to get through a Big Ten season. When I walk across that stage and get my varsity coat, it'll be because I earned it, not because somebody gave it to me because they felt bad for me. So that's after her third ACL, her third major injury that's kept her out of playing. And if you think about it, next year she should be a senior, you know, and she's still willing to come back and give it one more try and has actually had another surgery on her other knee to try to, you know, clean some things up. So she's had it, you know, she's had as tough as anybody. And, you know, I pray and I hope that she has a chance. I mean, just one, give her 1 year, maybe two, where she can, you know, feel good about her experience on the basketball court because she loves Michigan State, loves this place. So.
Well, she's actively involved in the game. I see her cheering the loudest on the bench.
Yeah, sometimes I have to, like, get her out of the way so I can call a play. She's jumping up so much, and you know, she just loves everybody here, and everyone's been so wonderful here, from, you know, Dr. Simon and Mark Hollis, obviously Izzo and D'Antonio. I mean, there's so much support and love here that I think she feels inspired to come back and prove to people that, you know, she's worthy of a scholarship.
Chemistry here among the coaches seems to me to be something really special.
It is. I mean, it's so different. I mean, I heard Izzo say once, it's like a bunch of Division II coaches as people in a big time BCS level. And what that means is, you know, when you're a Division II coach, because I've been one before, I mean, I was the head coach, the compliance coordinator, the academic advisor, and the senior women's administrator. So wore many hats. So in order to do that, you know, the men's basketball coach was the facility guy, and the golf coach handled, you know, certain different things. So what it does is force people to really connect and communicate, and, you know, we all wear different hats. So it's important to give to each other, and I think he's right about that. You know, I expected it to be a little more business-like, but I mean, I'll get phone messages and text messages from Mark D'Antonio, and he'll stop over. And obviously, I work with Izzo pretty closely on a day-to-day basis, and Coach Anastas and Kathy George and Jackie and Jake. I mean, there's just so many of them to really, you know, it just is special. It's special. And I think our recruits feel that. I really do. I think on the women's side, for us, maybe we're not selling the pro game as much as the men's side, and how we can get them millions of dollars at the next level, because that's not really where we're at with our game. But it's about a feeling, and how do they feel when they come to Michigan State? And when you have those kind of people you can put in front of them, it's pretty special.
How do you get a group of elite athletes to think about what happens after they finish playing?
Well, that's a tricky thing sometimes. I think, you know, for me, I actually try to get them to focus in on the moment, you know, and just how special it is to be here and what it means to be a Spartan and to appreciate the person to their right and to their left. And, you know, you won't remember sometimes all of the wins and the plays and whatnot, but you'll remember the feeling that you have playing with and fighting for and alongside your teammates, and the bond that you'll have will be forever. And I just think an athlete, it's a different kind of bond, and not to say anything's different or, you know, about students that are in programs, but, you know, when you are blood, sweat, and tears with the person, you know, to your right and to your left, it's just a different connection for the rest of your life. And so I always really try to get them not to play with each other, but to play for each other.
A transferable skill into the real world.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're more worried about being a good teammate than you are being the person, I think your team ends up having a lot more success. And I think this year's been probably the best example of that for us.
How often do you hear from your alumni?
Oh my gosh, I talk to them all the time. It's so great with social media now. I mean, on Twitter and certainly on Facebook and all the things that you can do. It's so nice to stay up with LaKendra, Porsche, Taylor. All three of those guys are playing pro. Cal comes back and forth. Satara's, you know, right as a graduate assistant for me and stay down with me. So, you know, there's many of them. I talk to Alyssa DeHaan quite a bit. Aisha Jefferson, I mean, you could just go Lauren H. Oh my gosh, there's probably a better example and a more impressive person out of our organization than Lauren H.
Now, one of my favorite stories that you tell is what I've come to call the Susie Merchant test, something that has little to do with athleticism, but everything to do with character. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, I figured this out a long time ago when I was a head coach and I was 25 years old. I always felt like I could figure out who was the most talented, but I really wanted a good team. So for us, we really, really focused on bringing good kids in. Now, how do you do that? So, you know, the NCAA has so many limits that we can go watch kids play. So one of the times I would save, my fifth and final time, I already knew they could, you know, they were the kid for our program in terms of athleticism. But I would go when they didn't know I was coming. I would never tell them, the AD, the principal, nobody knew. And I wouldn't wear any gear. And I'd sneak into the game and I would watch them. And I just watched how they interacted with their teammates and their coaches and the officials. And I hopefully picked a game where I knew they weren't going to play a lot. Actually, they were going to blow the team out. So I could see, do they cheer for their teammates when it's not about them? And I just think that's been a good recipe for me. Honestly, Scott, I think it's, you know, really allowed me to see truly someone's colors when they don't know you're there.
Anybody ever blow it?
Absolutely. I had a kid blow it, and she came out of the locker room. They had won a big game. It wasn't actually a blowout game. It was a rival game, and they had won it. And she's the oldest of four kids in a family that struggled. And she came out of the locker room, and her dad said, "Oh, honey, great game. So proud of you." And she looked at him and said, "Dad, I want the keys to the car. I'm going to Amanda's house." And I just thought, man, that's not right. Those people sacrificed a lot, and to just not engage with their family. And I just believe that that's how she would treat the coaches and her teammates. And she had a little bit of too much diva in them, is what I called it, a little bit too much diva for us. And we passed on her, and I'm glad we did.
She wasn't a Spartan.
She was not a Spartan.
She was. The Big Ten tournament and the dance are on the horizon. We should talk about that. What will your team be thinking about as you prepare?
Well, we have two more left in the regular season. We fly out tonight, and we play tomorrow at Purdue on the Big Ten Network. And then we play at home on Sunday on senior night. And, you know, really, it's been it's just like the men's side. And I know there's maybe not as many women's basketball fans out there, but it's very hard to win on the road. It's a very deep conference. Anybody can beat anybody any given night. So we have challenges ahead of us, that's for sure. We want to finish strong here and, you know, have a good showing in the Big Ten tournament. For us, we really want to position ourselves for a good seed in the NCAA tournament.
I love coming to women's games. It has a much more of a family feel. You can actually hear what's going on the court.
Yeah, you know, it's a different. I think people appreciate it because it's played below the rim for sure. And I think people have a more of a connection to the way the game used to be played back in the 70s, I should say, maybe even before that. So, you know, the fundamentals, the skill, the strategy, I think is a little more significant than the high-flying athleticism and size of the guys' game.
Susie Merchant, one of my all-time favorite people. Thank you for joining us on Current State.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
MSU women's head basketball coach Susie Merchant with the MSU Alumni Association Executive Director and Current State contributor Scott Westerman. There's more Current State coming up ahead. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stay with us. State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here today. The West African nation of Mali is well known for its spectacular art and musical traditions, as well as its famed historical city of Timbuktu. And until March of last year, it was also known as the most stable democracy in all of Africa. That image was shattered, however, when a military coup threw the country into chaos, leading to the displacement of nearly a half million people, a surge in Islamic rebel fighters in the north, and an influx of French troops and UN peacekeepers. MSU is one of the few universities in the country that maintains a study abroad program in Mali. The person largely responsible for that is Stephen Esquith. He's the dean of the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, and he joins me now to discuss what's happening in this culturally rich West African country. Welcome to Current State, Stephen.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's start by looking at Mali as a historically significant place in the world. Where is it geographically, and what made it important?
Mm-hmm. Well, you did a nice job leading into this.
Thank you.
And I'll just add a little bit more. If people know anything about Mali, they know Timbuktu.
Yeah.
That's a center of Islamic learning from the 13th century to the 17th century. Many manuscripts were collected there. Many religious leaders had their home there. It was a kind of mecca for religious scholars and other intellectuals of that period. So Timbuktu was the anchor and really the center of the Malian Empire and the civilizations that grew from that between those over those four centuries. After that, Mali sort of expanded its fame, again drawing on art and culture and many of the sort of fine arts that now we associate with Malian society, its fabric arts, what people know as mud cloth or bogolan, its music, which influenced American blues, and some of its architecture. Those are things that we know, you know, of Mali in its history. It was also a crossroads for many cultures, both north-south and east-west. The east-west trading routes along the Niger River and the north-south trade of salt and other fine arts and products that went from North Africa to South Africa. It's about the size of Texas and California combined. It has perhaps a population of only 14 million or so, and in terms of its economy, it's a struggling economy. As you said, it was a very well-known stable democracy since democratic politics were instituted in 1991, but underneath the surface there were deep problems which have now come to the surface since the coup in March of 2012.
Yeah, that's just a year and a half, or less than a year and a half ago. Briefly, what led to the coup?
Uh-huh. Well, people like to say it was both unexpected and complex, and I think both things are true. What led to the coup was sort of a combination of factors. There was great dissatisfaction among lower-ranking military officers who had been sent to the north to deal with some of the conflicts that were beginning to bubble up. They didn't have the supplies, they didn't have the support that they needed. There was a growing dissatisfaction among ethnic groups in the north, often referred to as the Tuareg, who felt that since 1991 they really hadn't benefited in the same way that other groups in Mali had benefited. There was a group of Malians who had worked in Libya, and after the coup in Libya returned to Mali, unemployed but well-armed, and throwing their support to the northern separatists, the Tuaregs, created a potent combination of dissatisfaction. Add to that greater interest by Al-Qaeda and other radical Islamist groups in the region who saw the vacuum, the political vacuum, and the military weakness in northern Mali as an opportunity to establish a stronghold, increase their revenues through narcotics trading and arms trading in the north. With all of that happening, the French looked across the Mediterranean and said, this is not a healthy situation for Western Europe and for French interests, and we think we need to do something, and the UN needs to do something.
And they have since settled down this mm-hmm. rather unstable situation.
Yeah, I think that's true. Settled down is a good way to describe it. It's not over. There still are many folks dissatisfied in the north, and French and Belgian and other UN peacekeeping troops are still there holding sort of things together, but we're not out of the woods, if we can use that metaphor in a mostly desert climate. We're not out of the woods quite yet, but things are moving in the right direction. And
An election is coming up.
And an election, very good. An election is coming up. July 28th is the scheduled election, and that'll be the first round. And Mali, like many countries, if there's no majority winner in the election, this is a presidential election, there would be a second runoff election in August around the 11th. But the election is not something that everybody thinks Mali is technically prepared for. They have to issue identification cards to many people who haven't had them. In the last two elections, there was some dissatisfaction. And Mali, unfortunately, is well known for its low voter turnout. And low voter turnout in this election might cast some doubt about the legitimacy of the elected government.
So it's unclear whether an election will lead to greater reconciliation or not?
Yeah, perfect question. And so the interim government right now has tried to put together, at the same time that they're organizing for the election, something that they call the National Commission for Dialogue and Reconciliation. Mali has a history of being a country in which dialogue and conversation and sort of collegial relationships between ethnic groups has generally held true, and they would like to see a reconciliation process occur, but they know they have to build it from the ground up. It can't simply be established as a national board that holds hearings and announces, you know, amnesty for certain groups. There has to be a longer process of discussion, conversation in regional dialogue forums. So they're moving to institute not just a national commission, but regional and local, at the commune level, it's called in Mali, conversations to deal with grievances and concerns about what crimes were committed during and after the coup.
Talk to us about Michigan State's activities in Mali then. How has all of this instability impacted student exchanges?
Good. Michigan State has been in Mali for 30 years now. The primary focus of the Michigan State efforts in Mali has been in the area of food security. So the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources has been working closely with USAID and Mali and partners to help institute reforms within agriculture. In addition, Michigan State's been involved in a project called the Afrobarometer, which through the Political Science Department here. So those are long-standing commitments, and they continue in Mali and have continued even through this period of instability.
They have?
Yeah.
Okay.
My own work, as you mentioned early on, has been through a study abroad program, which we created in 2004 in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. And we traveled to Mali four or five times during that time, taking about 20 students, working on civic engagement projects in Mali, in the arts and in education. In 2012, we had 17 students ready to go. We were about to purchase their visas, and we had to postpone the project because of the coup. I just returned from a trip to Mali after being away for a year, and I'm encouraged. I think we'll be back. The elections, of course, have to happen, but we're going back.
You bring Mali to Michigan State, though, as well. We do more than just send students to Mali.
Correct.
It works in reverse as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, correct. We've had several exchange programs with Malian students and intellectuals who've been in the residential college over the last 4 years, religious leaders, as well as artists and academics. We've had artists in residence, mudcloth artists, musicians, rappers, photographers. The richness of Malian culture continues to affect Michigan State through these exchange programs, and that's another part of the project that we want to reinvigorate. And we have Malian partners who are eager to host our students and our faculty and to share their traditions with us here.
Stephen Esquith is the dean of Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. His work and teaching focus on the West African nation of Mali. Thanks for joining us today, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Every year we're apt to buy the new updated versions of phones or computers and all kinds of other electronic gadgetry. So what happens with all the unwanted and obsolete items that we replace? Well, it becomes e-waste. And we welcome to the program Jim Grandholm. Jim is the founder of Green Earth Electronics Recycling. Jim, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
How much environmental threat does all this e-waste pose, or are companies like yours doing a pretty good job of recycling it all?
Well, we're making a small dent in a big problem that's a growing problem. I was just even looking prior to talking with you, but back in 2008-2009, a report on CBS News from the U.S. government, Natural Resources Defense Council, said that e-waste is the fastest-growing component of municipal waste worldwide right now. And back in 2009, the statistics said that we were throwing away, in the United States, 130,000 computers a day. Those were going into the landfills. And about 100 million cell phones were thrown away annually. So it's a big issue that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're making a dent, and others are making a dent as well. But what's great is even programs like this where you raise awareness, because what we're trying to do is keep things out of the landfills.
How are you making your dent then, exactly? What are you? You're recycling these items, is that it?
Well, we're doing several different things. Actually, as most know anything about recycling, the best way to recycle is to find a way to reuse. So the first thing that we're doing is trying to capture any type of equipment that may be obsolete, but perhaps it's something that could be upgraded or add new parts to and put it back in the marketplace. I was speaking to somebody just, I think it was yesterday, a 20-year-old, and I asked them if they knew what a typewriter was. And funny enough, they heard of it, but they weren't really sure exactly what it was. Well, as I went on with the conversation, you know, I said, "Well, what do you use for putting together documents?" Well, I use a laptop. I said, "Well, do you know what a desktop computer is?" "Yes, but that's ridiculous. They don't have one of those."
Wow.
And that's why it's the fastest growing component of municipal waste, is because literally I don't know what kind of cell phone you use, but I'm guessing you use a cell phone. Years ago, nobody used a cell phone. They had pagers. Then before that, they didn't have anything. But the big craze was the iPhones. Well, when the iPhone 4 came out, you know, you'd see all over the news that the lines all over the place, people waiting in line for the iPhone 4. Offer an iPhone 4 to somebody, and they laugh at you. Well, I don't want an iPhone 4. And we're collecting iPhone 4s that people are wanting to dispose of because they don't want the iPhone. It works fine.
Yeah.
It still works.
Yeah.
But they want the next best thing. And that's why we have such an issue with it. Technology is changing so fast, and we get a lot of good equipment. So we're trying to find ways to use things. We collect so many computers that we can refurbish and redo something with. A desktop computer that literally now people that could never afford a computer. I mean, do you remember 5-8 years ago to buy a desktop computer was $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
And that's with a big giant CRT monitor. Well, now, you know, people couldn't afford that. So now what's happening is if we can do things right and continue education in that, people that never had a computer can at least now have a computer. It's not going to be the iPad. It's not going to be the top-of-the-line laptop, but they can get a desktop now computer and now get on the internet and do things they need to do. And, you know, it's good for students. So, you know, it's really a lot of education.
What can consumers do who are concerned about this problem? How can they alter their behaviors to improve this situation?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we do a lot of electronics recycling events, mostly in the mid to southwestern Michigan area. And, you know, basically people are afraid of it. I mean, we will do recycling events and people will sit in their cars and they're afraid to get out. They're afraid to give us their things. Because they just know, they don't know what they don't know. And so they're like, well, I hear there's, I shouldn't be giving this away because it's got information on it. And I go, well, you know, you're not storing information on your typewriter. But your computer, yes, it does have information. So literally, you don't want to just recycle it. You want to make sure that it's, there is, it's why there's a fear, and it's why there's kind of a lot of people hold back things, is they just don't know what to do, and they're fearful of where does the confidential information rest, and how do I get that so that I'm protected? And that's exactly one of the services that we provide, is we try to do everything we can to help put people at ease. I mean, we pick up a computer from somebody, we wipe the computers, the hard drives with a Department of Defense level wiping. We pick up and do a lot of businesses. We do banks and medical centers. Well, we'll take the hard drives and shred the hard drives so that there is no way anything could ever possibly be recaptured from that.
Okay.
So it's really trying to do everything we can to help facilitate and educate people, too. Because if they know that, hey, there's a comfortable place, this is a professional company or organization that's collecting this stuff and it's being processed, then people are just, they get emotional at some of these recycling events.
Wow. We're talking with Jim Grandholm, who is the founder of Green Earth Electronics Recycling. My family's taken old computers and printers to a recycling event sponsored by our township. What typically happens to all that stuff?
Well, that's one of two things generally. One is the computer something that has any ability to be refurbished and used again? Like I said, maybe it's a low-end computer, but you can put a bigger hard drive in it, more RAM, and literally now provide it to somebody that can't afford a computer, and that $1,000 computer might, you know, somebody would be happy to pay $50 or $100 for it to just have a computer. But what we see is a lot of that is so ancient that what we do is we do the demanufacturing. We do have a huge demanufacturing process. So what we'll do is you bring in a computer, for example, we will take it and start taking it apart. And if there's any components within it that can be reused, if the whole computer can't be reused, then we'll see if there's any components within the computer or any of the other electronics that can be reused. And then the rest is parted out and separated in the type of component in which it needs to be recycled. So that's where literally a computer, it depends on who you speak to, but a whole computer going into the landfill, many consider hazardous waste. It'll sit there. There's no way that thing's ever going to biodegrade into the soil. But if you take the components out and then they get cycled, they can be recycled and made into new computers, and thus keeping as well a large volume out of the landfills.
What's at the top of your list of electronic junk that concerns you the most? What is cluttering up landfills the most?
Well, I'll tell you what the thing that concerns me, the biggest issue we have in electronics recycling right now is still what are the TV, the old CRT tube TVs, and a CRT monitor.
Really?
Which is not the flat panel monitor, they're the round, heavier ones. They weigh 20, 30, 40 pounds. But those actually have a lead that's in the glass. So those are considered hazardous waste if you open them up. As a component themselves, they're all right. But we don't want them in the landfills. We want them to be taken to a place where they are demanufactured, the lead is extracted, and again, the glass can be remade into something else. But if you take TVs and CRTs and start throwing them into landfills, I mean, you just got a mess on your hands.
Yeah, yeah. I ran into a guy on vacation years ago, who was kind of a 21st century gold prospector, I guess. And this guy insisted that there is enough, acquired discarded television sets and claimed that there was gold. there were some tiny bits of gold in these television sets, to the point where it made it profitable for him to actually acquire these things, tear them apart, and get at that gold. Is anything like that happening in this industry?
Well, that's what's really interesting is TVs, I'm not aware of having any gold. What they have, the commodity value that they have in them is copper. you have a cord that's got a little piece of copper in it. And on the back of a tube TV is what's called a copper yoke. Now, you get enough of those, and you know, you can make, a quantity of those. The copper is expensive, not necessarily gold. Now, we get this all the time. Their computers are made with, there's precious metals in them. There's gold, there's silver, there's palladium, there's different things that have value. And the older computers, which is why they were so expensive, had much more of it. Now, why is it that a computer that used to be $1,000 is down to $200? Well, it isn't because they've refined the process so much that there's less and less of those precious metals in them. But that's where, you know, interesting enough, sadly, what we see is people going out and saying, oh, yeah, we recycle TVs and CRTs, and literally they will cut the cord off the TV, take a hammer, bust the thing in the back, get the copper yoke out, and go throw it in somebody's dumpster.
Well, so Jim, make a quick recommendation or two that might be overlooked by a lot of people as far as addressing e-waste and what they might be able to do.
Well, the first thing I would do is, like in the state of Michigan, is you can contact your county. Your county, somebody at your county, in almost every county that I'm aware of in Michigan now, has somebody that's overseeing the waste stream. And specifically, you can go we encourage recycling of everything, but paints, medications, everything, tires. But you contact your county and say, listen, where can I go or what do I do? A lot of the counties will say, listen, I live in Berrien County up here in southwestern Michigan, and Berrien County hosts several different recycling events where they will bring in people to handle all those things. So Lake Michigan College up here a couple months back had a huge recycling event of which we handled the electronics. So they had people there to take books. They took glasses. They took glass. They took styrofoam. They took paints and hazardous liquids. They took all those medications, and it was great. The line never ended. I've never seen anything like it. But people love the idea of disposing of things properly. So I would say contact, you know, your county and find out who it is or what options you have to recycle and make sure that you recycle it properly.
Yeah. Jim Grandholm is the founder of the Michigan-based Green Earth Electronics Recycling. Fascinating stuff, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
This environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at greatlakesecho.org. That's Current State for today. Our engineer is Aaron Young. Joe Lindstroth produces our program. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.